women and children had fled from the Taliban rebels who had taken over the government of their country. Finally, they reached the border between Afghanistan and Tajikistan, the mountainous country north of Afghanistan. Soldiers on the Tajik side would not let them in. The Taliban would not let them go back. On islands in the middle of a river, they lived in mud huts and ate grass, slowly starving. "Since I started working in Pakistan, I haven't slept much," Greg said. "But that winter of 1999 and 2000, I hardly slept at all. I was up all night pacing my basement, trying to find some way to help them." Greg wrote letters to the newspapers, to the president, to Congress, trying to get someone to help the refugees. "But no one cared," Greg said. "Bottom line is, I failed. I couldn't make anyone care. And Tara will tell you I was a nightmare. All I could think about was all those freezing children who'd never had a chance to grow up, helpless out there between groups of men with guns. I was actually going a bit crazy. It was amazing that Tara put up with me that winter." In times of war, he went on, you often hear leaders, Christian, Jewish, and Muslim, saying, God is on our side. But that isn't true. God is on the side of refugees, widows, and orphans. But on July 24, 2000, Greg's spirit lifted. That day, Tara gave birth to their son, Khyber Bishop Mortensen, at home. Greg felt happy for the first time in months. Later, he wrapped his son in a fuzzy blanket and brought him to Amira's preschool class for show and tell. Amira proudly showed off her new baby brother's tiny fingers and toes. "He's so small and wrinkly," said one of Amira's classmates, a blonde four-year-old. "Do little babies like that grow up to be big like us?" "Inshallah," Greg said. "Huh? I hope so, sweetie," Greg said. "I sure hope so." Chapter 19. A Village Called New York. On September 10th, 2001, Greg and George McCown were headed for a town called Zut Khan, at the very tip of northern Pakistan, near the border with Afghanistan. It was the hometown of Faisal Beg, who had been a porter on McCown's expedition to K2 and afterward came to work for the CAI as Greg's bodyguard. The CAI had paid for three improvements there: a water project, a small power plant, and a dispensary where medicine could be given out to villagers who needed it. George McCown, who had donated $8,000 toward the projects in Zut Khan, was traveling with Greg, McCown's son Dan, and Dan's wife Susan, to see what the CAI had done. Zut Khan's mud brick houses matched the color of the valley floor. It was hard to see the town until they were almost on top of it. On the polo field, Faisal Beg was standing proudly among a crowd of villagers, waiting to welcome his guests. Beg lifted McCown off the ground in a bone-crushing hug. "Faisal is a true gem," McCown said. "We'd stayed in touch ever since my trip to K2, when he got me and my bum knee down the Baltoro and practically saved the life of my daughter Amy, who he carried most of the way down after she got sick. There in his home village, he was so proud to show us around. He organized a royal welcome." Musicians blowing horns and banging drums led the visitors down a line of all 300 people in Zut Khan. Greg had been to the village several times before and was greeted like family. The men hugged Greg and the women kissed him in the traditional way, laying their palms on his cheek and kissing the backs of their own hands. Greg and McCown looked at the pipes that carried water to the town from a mountain stream and switched on the small generator powered by the water. The generator created enough electricity to light lamps in a few dozen houses for a couple of hours every evening. The two men also visited the new dispensary, where Aziza Hussein, the first healthcare worker in Zut Khan, had just returned from 6 months of training. Now, with the simple medical supplies that the CAI had paid for, she hoped to be able to help people with illnesses that could easily be treated but had been deadly before, simply because there were no doctors or clinics nearby. Before Aziza took charge of healthcare in her village, many people had died. After I got training and Dr. Greg provided the medicines, with good water from the new pipes and teaching the people how to clean their children and use clean food, not a single person has died from these problems, says Aziza. It's my great interest to continue to develop myself in this field and pass on my training to other women. Now that we have made such progress, not a single person in this area believes women should not be educated. The next day was September 11th, 2001. Everyone gathered at the stage set up at the edge of the polo ground. Village elders performed a traditional dance of welcome, and Greg got up to dance with them. The entire village howled in appreciation. There were endless speeches, some by students in Zutkan school, proud to display their skill in English. "We were lonely here in Zutkan," one boy said. "But Dr. Greg and Mr. George wanted to improve our village, for the benefit of the poor and needy of this world, like the Zutkan people. We tell our benefactors, thank you." The ceremony finished up with a polo match. The players rode bareback on horses and tried to hit the goat skull used as a ball into the goals. At 4:30 the next morning, Beg shook Greg awake. He had a portable radio pressed against his ear. Greg saw an expression on Beg's face that he had never seen there before. Fear. "Dr. Saheb, Dr. Saheb, big problem," Beg said. "Up, up." "Assalamu alaikum, Faisal," Greg said. "How are you?" "I'm sorry," Beg said. "Why?" Greg asked. "A village called New York has been bombed." Greg pulled a yak hair blanket over his shoulders and stepped outside. Beg's brother was there with a gun, guarding his American guests. The village mullah stood outside also, looking toward Afghanistan. A friend of Beg's fiddled with his radio, trying to get more news. All anybody could figure out was that there had been a terrorist attack, and the two towers of the World Trade Center in New York had fallen. "Your problem in New York Village comes from there," Beg said. He spat towards Afghanistan. "From Osama." A helicopter arrived in Zutkan shortly after to pick up Greg, McCown, and his family. It was sent by Brigadier General Bashir Baz, who had retired from Pakistan's army to run an air charter company, flying people around Pakistan. Since he'd learned of Greg Mortensen's work, he'd volunteered his planes and pilots to bring Greg to the remote corners of Pakistan. "I've met a lot of people in my life, but no one like Greg Mortensen," Bashir said. "Taking into account how hard he works for the children of my country, offering a flight now and then is the least I can do." Guards with guns jumped out and helped the Americans into the helicopter. Faisal Beg came along as well, just to be sure that his friends were safe. After the helicopter lifted off from Zutkan, they used Greg's satellite phone to call home. From Tara and McCown's wife Karen, they learned the details of the terrorist attacks that had destroyed the World Trade Towers of New York City, damaged the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., and crashed a plane in a field in Pennsylvania. More than 3,000 people had been killed. Everyone was worried that Americans like Greg and McCown would now become targets of the terrorists who had attacked the United States. Tara was so relieved to hear from her husband that she burst into tears. "I know you with your second family, and they'll keep you safe," she shouted into the phone over the crackling static. "Finish your work and then come home to me, my love." The helicopter took the Americans to a vacation spot, a fishing resort used by Pakistan's generals near Skardu. McCown wanted to get himself and his family out of Pakistan immediately, but the borders were shut down. No one was allowed in or out. Finally, Greg told him, "You're in the safest place on earth right now. These people will protect you with their lives. Since you can't go anywhere, why don't we stick to the original program until we can put you on a plane?" On Friday, September 14th, Greg and McCown traveled to Qardu, Cengiz's village, as part of a crowd that was much larger than they had expected. Children had actually been going to the school in Qardu for years. But Cengiz wanted an official ceremony to inaugurate or open it, with as many speeches and important people as possible. It seemed like every politician, policeman, and military and religious leader in northern Pakistan came along to help inaugurate the Qardu school, Greg said. Saeed Abbas gave the most important speech. "Today is the day that you children will remember forever and tell your grandchildren," he said. "Today, from the darkness of illiteracy, the light of education shines bright. We share in sorrow, as people weep and suffer in America today, as we inaugurate the school. Those who have committed this evil act against the innocent, the women and children, to create thousands of widows and orphans, do not do so in the name of Islam. By the grace of Allah the Almighty, may justice be served upon them. For this tragedy, I humbly ask Mr. George and Dr. Greg Saheb for their forgiveness. All of you, my brethren, protect and embrace these two American brothers in our midst. Let no harm come to them. Share all you have to make their mission successful." Saeed Abbas paused, as if considering what to say next. Even the youngest children among the hundreds of people packed into the school's courtyard were silent. "I request America to look into our hearts," he went on, "and see that the great majority of us are not terrorists, but good and simple people. Our land is stricken with poverty because we are without education, but today, another candle of knowledge has been lit. In the name of Allah the Almighty, may it light our way out of the darkness we find ourselves in." It was an incredible speech, Greg said, and by the time Saeed Abbas had finished, the entire crowd was in tears. "I wish all the Americans who think Muslim is just another way of saying terrorist could have been there that day. The true core tenets of Islam are justice, tolerance, and charity." After the ceremony, many of the widows of Qardu lined up to meet Greg and McCown. They pressed eggs into their hands, a traditional symbol of grief and mourning. They begged the two Americans to take the eggs to the women they thought of as sisters, the new widows far away in a village called New York. The next day, Brigadier General Bashir himself flew McCown and his family in a helicopter to the airport, where they caught a plane home. "Thinking back on all of it," McCown said, "no one in Pakistan was anything but wonderful to us. I was so worried about what might happen to me, but nothing did." Greg stayed in Pakistan and made his way to Corfe. During his many visits to Pakistan over the years, Greg always tried to stop by Corfe and visit with Haji Ali. As he walked over the swaying bridge, Greg realized that the high point where Haji Ali always stood to greet him was empty. Twaha met Greg at the riverbank and gave him the news. His father had died a month ago. The last fall, when Greg had come to visit Corfe, Sakina had been very ill. She died, refusing to leave Corfe to be taken to a hospital. Greg and Haji Ali had visited her grave. "I'm nothing without her," Haji Ali told his American son. "Nothing at all." Then Haji Ali put his hand on Greg's shoulder, and at first Greg thought he was crying. But he was laughing. "One day soon, you're going to come here looking for me, and find me planted in the ground too," Haji Ali said, chuckling. Greg couldn't find anything funny in the idea of Haji Ali dying. He hugged the old man who'd already taught him so much and asked for one lesson more. "What should I do when that time comes?" he asked. Haji Ali looked up at the summit of Corfe K2. "Listen to the wind," he said. Now, with Twaha, Greg knelt by the grave of Corfe's old chief. Then he stood up, trying to imagine what Haji Ali would have said at such a moment. He remembered the old chief's words, "Listen to the wind." Greg heard the wind whistling down the Braldu Gorge. It carried to him the sounds of Corfe's children playing in the courtyard of the school. Here was Haji Ali's last lesson, he realized. "Think of them," he told himself. "Think only of them." Chapter 20. Afghanistan. Faisal Beg had been right. Osama bin Laden had said that his organization, Al-Qaeda, was responsible for the attacks on September 11th. Afghanistan, where Al-Qaeda was based, refused to allow foreign reporters to enter the country. The head of the Taliban government, Mullah Omar, had decided not to hand bin Laden over to the United States. War between the United States and Afghanistan, Pakistan's neighbor, seemed very likely. The American embassy, which represents America in Pakistan, had warned that Pakistan was no longer a safe place for Americans to visit. But Greg Mortensen wouldn't leave. He had work to do, visiting the CAI schools at refugee camps to see if they would be able to handle the many new students who would come once the fighting started. While in Pakistan, Greg gave an interview to a reporter who had gone with him to visit Afghan refugee schools. Greg asked Americans back home not to assume that all Muslims were guilty of terrorism. The families in the refugee camps, Greg said, weren't villains. They were victims. "These aren't the terrorists. These aren't the bad people," he said. He explained that the difference between becoming a good local citizen and a terrorist could be in education. The warnings from the embassy got more and more serious. Eventually, all Americans were ordered to leave Pakistan as war began in earnest between the United States and Afghanistan. Instead of leaving, Greg bought a plane ticket to Skardu and flew back into a war zone. He spent the next month driving back and forth across northern Pakistan, checking on all the CAI projects, making sure everything was completed before the winter began. At the end of October, he finally got ready to head back to America. His friend and bodyguard, Faisal Beg, drove him to the airport. Beg had dedicated himself to making sure Greg was safe anywhere he went in Pakistan. Now, as he said goodbye to his American friend, he had tears in his eyes. "What is it, Faisal?" Greg asked, squeezing his shoulder. "Now your country is at war," Beg said. "What can I do? How can I protect you there?" Later, when Greg arrived home, he found out his interview with the reporter had been published by many newspapers across the country. For the first time in his life, Greg found himself opening hate mail from fellow Americans. Unsigned letters from around the country called Greg a traitor and wished pain upon him. "For the first time since I started my work in Pakistan, I thought about quitting," Greg says. "I expected something like this from an ignorant village mullah, but to get those kinds of letters from my fellow Americans made me wonder whether I should give up." But it was his wife, Tara, who encouraged Greg to go on. "Now more than ever, people in the United States need to hear about your message to promote peace and hope through education. Don't give up now," she said. But soon, Greg would find himself in danger again. This time, it wouldn't be in Pakistan or the United States, but in Afghanistan. A year before the terrorist attacks of September 11th, Greg had visited Faisal Beg's village near the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan. Standing with Beg, looking toward the border, he'd been startled to see a band of a dozen horsemen riding toward him. "They jumped off their horses and came straight at me," he said. "They were the wildest-looking men I'd ever seen." He remembered the time he'd been kidnapped in Waziristan in 1996 and thought, "Oof, here we go again." The leader, a man with a rifle slung over his shoulder, strode toward Greg. Beg stepped into his path. Then, a moment later, the two men were hugging and talking excitedly. "My friend," Beg told Greg. "He looks for you many times." Beg's friend, a village chief, was a nomad, meaning a person who moves from place to place, of the Kyrgyz tribe. He and his men had ridden for 6 days to find Greg. "For me, hard life is no problem," he said as Beg translated his words for Greg. "But for children, no good. We have not much food, not much house, and no school. We know about Dr. Greg built school in Pakistan, so you can come build for us? We give land, stone, men, everything. Come now and stay with us for the winter, so we can have good discuss and make school?" Greg explained that he had to go home in a few days, and that he'd need the approval of the CAI board for a new project, but he swore to himself that he'd find a way to help these Afghans. He laid his hand on the man's shoulder. "Tell him I need to go home now. Tell him working in Afghanistan is very difficult for me," he told Beg. "But I promise I come visit his family as soon as I can. Then we discuss if building some school is possible." The man smiled and laid his own hand on Greg's shoulder. Then he and his men returned to Afghanistan to report back to Commandant Abdul Rashid Khan, the warlord who controlled their part of Afghanistan. Now, in the winter of 2002, more than a year after the attacks of September 11th, Greg thought he might be able to start keeping his promise to those Afghan horsemen. American soldiers, fighting alongside Afghan troops known as the Northern Alliance, had driven the Taliban from power. Greg, understanding that the Taliban had supported and protected Osama bin Laden and his Al-Qaeda terrorist groups, had approved of the war at first. But he became more and more upset as he heard how many civilians, ordinary people who were not soldiers, were dying as American planes dropped bombs. Some of the dead, Greg was sure, must be children. He heard from staff members how children in Afghan refugee camps often picked up the bright yellow pods of unexploded cluster bombs because they looked like the yellow packets of food that American planes dropped. He worried about the students who studied at CAI schools in the refugee camps in Pakistan. Some had returned with their families to Afghanistan before this new fighting. At night, he remembered their faces and wondered if they were still alive. There was still fighting in some areas of Afghanistan, but Greg decided that the capital, Kabul, which was in the hands of the American forces, was probably safe enough for him to visit. Once his plane had landed in Kabul, he wasn't so sure. He could see pieces of bombed planes lying by the runway. At his hotel, which had no electricity or running water, Greg could hear guns firing and rockets landing outside. With the help of his taxi driver, Abdullah Rahman, and a friend of his, Greg drove around Kabul to see schools and figure out what kind of help might be needed. The schools had been badly damaged in the war, but were supposed to reopen later that spring. But only a few of Kabul's 159 schools were able to hold classes, and even these that were still standing had to take groups of students in shifts, one after the other, sometimes holding classes outside or in buildings that were more like piles of rubble than anything else. At the Durrani High School, Greg met the principal, Uzra Faizad. She told Greg that the number of students who wanted to go to her school grew every day. Under the Taliban, girls had been forbidden to go to school. Now with the Taliban gone, they were trying to get the education that had been kept from them. "I was just overwhelmed listening to Uzra's story," Greg said. Here was this strong, proud woman trying to do the impossible. Her school's boundary wall had been blown to rubble. The roof had fallen in. Still, she was coming to work every day, putting the place back together because she was passionate about education being the only way to solve Afghanistan's problems. Greg decided to return to Pakistan, gather up some school supplies, and come back to Kabul to start helping out in any way he could. Julia Bergman, who worked on the CAI's board, came with him. The trip to Kabul took 11 hours. "I was surprised to see that the whole border area was wide open," Greg says. "All along the road we saw burned out bomb tanks and other military vehicles," says Bergman. Greg and Bergman toured the schools in Kabul and nearby towns, trying to help where they could. At one middle school, they saw classes being held inside huge metal shipping containers and a rusty tank. The girls had no shelter at all. 80 girls were forced to study outside, Greg said. They were trying to hold class, but the wind kept whipping sand in their eyes and tipping over their blackboard. Greg unloaded notebooks and pencils from Abdullah's taxi. The girls were thrilled and clutched the notebooks tightly to keep them from blowing away. As Greg walked back toward the taxi, four U.S. Army helicopters dipped down from the sky to fly overhead at high speed. The students at the school were terrified. The girls' blackboards blew over in the wind created by the helicopters and shattered against the stony ground. The next day, Greg and Bergman went to deliver supplies to Uzra Faizad's school. They saw that her students had to climb up ladders built of logs to get into classrooms on the second floor because the stairs had been blown away. But even so, the school was teaching 3 shifts of students every day. Uzra was delighted to see them and invited them into her home, a one-room shed on the school's property. During the time of the Taliban, Uzra had taught girls secretly. Now that the Taliban had gone, she talked openly about how important it was for girls to get an education. She served her guests tea, apologizing that she had no sugar to go with it. "There's one favor I must ask you," Uzra said after everyone had tasted their tea. "We're very grateful that the Americans chased out the Taliban, but for 5 months now I haven't received my salary, even though I was told to expect it soon. Can you discuss my problem with someone in America to see if they know what happened?" Greg gave Uzra $40 and another $20 for each of her teachers. On the plane back home, he could not stop thinking about her. "I was so upset, I paced the aisles of the planes all the way to Washington, D.C., he said. "If we couldn't do something as simple as seeing that a hero like Uzra gets her $40 a month salary, then how could we ever hope to do the hard work it takes to win the war on terror?" When he was not traveling in Afghanistan and Pakistan, Greg spent much of his time giving speeches, telling people about the CAI and its work, and the lives of the poor in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Sometimes he spoke to large crowds, sometimes to small groups. Once, before his trip to Kabul with Bergman, he met 6 people in a basement room in Montana and told them about himself, the CAI, and the mistakes he believed the U.S. government was making and the way it was fighting the war in Afghanistan. After his speech, one of his listeners introduced herself. "I'm Mary Bono," she said. "Actually, Representative Mary Bono." She was a member of the U.S. House of Representatives. "I have to tell you, I've learned more from you in the last hour than I have in all the briefings I've been to on Capitol Hill since September 11th, she went on. "We've got to get you up there." She handed him her business card with her telephone number on it and told him to call her to schedule a speech in Washington. When he arrived back in the United States after his trip to Kabul, Greg did just that. With his mind on everything he'd just seen in Afghanistan, he landed in Washington, D.C. "When I arrived, I had no idea what to do. I felt like I'd been dropped in a remote Afghan village where I didn't know the customs," Greg said. "Mary spent an entire day with me, showing me how everything worked. She started introducing me around, saying, 'Here's someone you need to meet. This is Greg Mortensen.' He was embarrassed when she told people, 'He's a real American hero.'" Bono had arranged for Greg to give a lecture and invited every member of Congress to come. "After I heard Greg speak, it was the least I could do," Bono says. "I meet so many people day in, day out, who say they're trying to do good and help people, but Greg is the real thing, and I'm his biggest fan. The sacrifices he and his family have made are staggering. He represents the best of America." After setting up his old slide projector, still held together with duct tape, Greg turned to face the room full of people. He spoke about Uzra and her missing salary, and about how important it was that America keep its promise to rebuild Afghanistan. One congressman interrupted him. "Building schools for kids is just fine and dandy," he said. "But our primary need as a nation now is security. Without security, what does all this matter?" Greg took a breath. He felt his anger flare, but he tried to speak calmly. "I don't do what I'm doing to fight terror," he said. "I do it because I care about kids. But working over there, I've learned a few things. I've learned that terror doesn't happen because some group of people, somewhere like Pakistan or Afghanistan, simply decide to hate us. It happens because children aren't being offered a bright enough future that they had a reason to choose life over death." Greg hoped he'd said enough to convince some of the people in that room that the danger to America from terrorists like Al-Qaeda would go away only when the children of countries like Afghanistan and Pakistan could get an education that would lift them out of poverty. With a chance at a better life, they would not be easy prey for terrorists who taught them to hate countries like the United States. Better schools in Afghanistan and Pakistan would leave the United States more secure, Greg thought. He hoped the politicians in the room believed him. Chapter 21. The First Educated Women in Corfe. In 2002, Greg was back in Corfe, and this time he'd brought along a reporter named Kevin Fedarko. Fedarko was reporting on the fighting between India and Pakistan, and he'd asked for Greg's assistance. Greg bent over backward to help me. I had no connections in Pakistan and never could have done it myself, Fedarko said. On their first day in Corfe, Fedarko watched as Greg and the elders of the village had a meeting. There was always a lot to work out, Greg said. I had to get reports about the school, find out if anything needed fixing, if the students needed supplies, if the teachers were getting their pay regularly. It was business as usual, with everyone talking, laughing, shouting, and arguing, when something happened that was not usual at all. A young woman walked into the room and took a seat in front of Greg. She spoke up, interrupting the men who were talking all around her. Dr. Greg, she said in Balti, you made our village a promise once, and you fulfilled it when you built our school. But you made me another promise the day the school was completed. Do you remember it? Whenever Greg visited one of CAI's schools, he made it a point to shake every student's hand and ask each one what he or she wanted to be one day. He remembered this girl well. The young woman was Jahan, Twaha's daughter and Haji Ali's granddaughter. And the promise Greg had made to her was one he made to all the students in the CAI schools, that if they studied hard, he would help them reach whatever goals they set for themselves. Jahan had been one of Corfe's best students. Greg had often listened to her talk about her hopes for a career. I told you my dream was to be a doctor one day, and you said you would help, Jahan told Greg. Well, that day is here. You must keep your promise to me. I'm ready to begin my medical training, and I need 20,000 rupees. Jahan unfolded a piece of paper and gave it to Greg. On it she'd written, in English, a description of the school she wanted to attend in Skardu, the courses she would take, and how much it would cost. This is great, Jahan, said Greg. I'll read it when I have time and discuss it with your father. No, Jahan exclaimed in English. Then she switched back to Balti. You don't understand. My class starts next week. I need money now. Greg grinned. He was delighted to see that Jahan had learned one of the lessons he hoped all the girls at the CAI schools would learn, how to stand up for herself. From a child's pink backpack full of CAI money, he counted out 20,000 rupees, about $400, and handed it to Jahan's father for her tuition. Kevin Fedarko, the reporter, had been watching in amazement. It was one of the most incredible things I'd seen in my life, he said. Here comes this teenage girl in the center of a very conservative Islamic village, waltzing into a circle of men, breaking through 16 layers of tradition at once. She had graduated from school and was the first educated woman in a valley of about 600 people. She didn't defer to anyone, sat down right in front of Greg and handed him a proposal, in English, to better herself and improve the life of her village. I told Greg, what you're doing here is a much more important story than the one I've come to report. I have to find some way to tell it. Later that fall in New York City, Fedarko had lunch with an old friend who was the editor of Parade magazine and told him all about the CAI's work. The editor called Greg. In the spring of 2003, just as the United States war against Iraq began, 34 million copies of the magazine went out to readers with Greg Mortensen's picture on the cover. Inside, Fedarko told the story of Jahan's bold plans for her education and of Greg Mortensen's work. If we truly want a legacy of peace for our children, Greg said in the article, we need to understand that this is a war that will ultimately be won with books, not with bombs. In one day, that article reached more people than Greg could have reached with months of speeches. Letters and emails poured in from all over the United States and from 20 foreign countries. A few days after the story appeared, Greg went to the post office for his mail. There was a note in his post office box telling him to pick up his letters at the counter. So you're Greg Mortensen, the postmaster said. I hope you brought a wheelbarrow. Greg loaded 5 sacks of mail into his car. He came back the next day for 4 more. I felt like America had spoken. My tribe had spoken, Greg said. And the amazing thing was, there was only one negative letter in the whole bunch. Greg went on to say, what really humbled me was how the response came from all sorts of people, from church groups, Muslims, Hindus, and Jews, and many of the letters came with donations. Jake, a 13-year-old from Philadelphia, sent $1,000 of his bar mitzvah money. A captain in the U.S. Army wrote that the CAI was now his favorite charity. Gradually, the CAI had more than $1 million in the bank. Greg wanted to get right back to Pakistan and Afghanistan and put the money to work, but he agreed to a few things that the board wanted. A real office for the CAI, some staff to work there, and, at long last, a raise for himself. Greg was also able to give raises to the people who worked for him in Pakistan, and he had a new idea. For a long time, I've been worrying about what to do when our students graduate, he said during his next trip to Pakistan. Mr. Parvi, would you look into what it would cost to build a hostel in an expensive place to sleep in Skardu so our best students would have some place to stay if we give them scholarships to continue their education? I'd be delighted, Dr. Saib, said Parvi, smiling. Oh, and one more thing, Greg said. Yes, Dr. Greg, sir. Yasmin would be a perfect candidate to receive one of the CAI's first scholarships. Can you let me know what her tuition would be if she went to a private high school in the fall? Yasmin was Parvi's 15-year-old daughter. For a rare moment, the normally talkative glum Parvi was struck dumb, his mouth hanging open. I don't know what to say, he said. Allah Akbar! Another CAI worker shouted as everybody at the meeting exploded into laughter. In the fall of 2003, the same year the article appeared in Parade, Greg returned to Skardu. There, he met Jahan and her classmate Tahira, who had come to Skardu together to go to high school, both with scholarships from the CAI. On his last day in town, Greg stopped by with Jahan's father, Twaha, to see how the girls were doing in the apartment they shared. Jahan proudly served him tea, as her grandmother Sakina had done so often. Tahira told Greg that, once she graduated, she planned to return to Corfe to teach along with her father, Hussein. When she and Jahan went upside or back into the mountains to Corfe, she saw a difference in how people treated her. I've had this chance, she said. Now when we go upside, all the people look at us, our clothes, and think we're fashionable ladies. I think every girl of the Braldu deserves the chance to come downside at least once. Then their life will change. I think the greatest service I can perform is to go back and ensure this happens for all of them. Jahan refilled Greg's teacup. Before I met you, Dr. Greg, I had no idea what education was, she said. But now I think it's like water. It is important for everything in life. What about marriage? Greg asked. He knew that once Jahan got married, a Balti husband might not support her goals to educate herself. Don't worry, Dr. Greg, Twaha said, laughing. This girl has learned your lesson too well. She has already made it clear she must first finish her studies before we can even discuss marrying her to a suitable boy. And I agree. I will sell all my land if necessary so she can complete her education. I owe that to the memory of my father. So what will you do? Greg asked Jahan. You won't laugh, she said. I might, Greg teased. Jahan took a breath. When I was a little girl, and I would see a gentleman or a lady with good clean clothes, I would run away and hide my face. But after I graduated from the Corfe school, I felt a big change in my life. I felt I was clear and clean and could go before anybody and discuss anything. And now that I'm already in Skardu, I feel that anything's possible. I don't want to just be a health worker. I want to be such a woman that I can start a hospital and look over all the health problems of all the women in Braldu. And I want to become a very famous woman of this area. Jahan went on, twirling the hem of her headscarf around her finger. I want to be a super lady, she said, grinning, as if daring anyone to tell her that she couldn't. Greg didn't laugh. He imagined how proud Haji Ali would have felt if he'd lived long enough to see this day. Chapter 22. Stones into Schools. The king sat in the window seat. Greg recognized Zayish Shah, the king of Afghanistan, from pictures on old Afghan money. The king and Greg were both on a flight to Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan. When Shah looked away from the window, he met Greg's eyes. "Assalamu alaikum, sir," Greg said. "And to you, sir," Shah replied. "American?" "Yes, sir," Greg said. "Are you a journalist?" the king asked. "No, sir," Greg said. "I build schools for girls." "And what is your business in my country, if I may ask?" "I begin construction of 5 or 6 schools in the spring, inshallah," Greg explained. "I'm coming to deliver the money to get them going." Greg explained that his schools would not be in Kabul, the capital, but in the Wakhan, the distant area near the border with Pakistan. The king was surprised. Greg told him the story of the Afghan horseman who'd ridden over into Pakistan and asked him to bring schools to their villages. "I promised them I'd come, discuss schools with them, but I haven't been able to get there until now," he said. "We don't see many Americans in Afghanistan anymore," the king said. "A year ago, this plane would have been full of journalists and aid workers, but now they're all in Iraq. America has forgotten us." Then he placed his hand on Greg's. "I'm glad one American is here at least," he said. "The man you want to see up north is Commandant Sardar Khan." The king gave Greg his business card, and on the back of it he printed his thumbprint in black ink. "It might be helpful," he said, "if Greg showed the card to Khan." "Allah be with you," he added, "and go with my blessing." Greg wanted to go from Kabul to Faizabad, the largest city in northeastern Afghanistan. He knew it would be a dangerous 2-day trip through the countryside, but he didn't feel that he had a choice. He was determined to keep his promise to the Kyrgyz horsemen. While he had been gone, they had traveled 6 days each way to deliver a message to Faisal Beg. There were more than 5,000 students in their area and no schools at all. They were waiting, inshallah, for Greg to come and build them. Greg sent his friend Abdullah out to rent a car or truck that could travel over the rough countryside. At midnight, he was awakened by a loud knocking on the door of his hotel room. Abdullah had good news. He'd rented a jeep and found a young man named Kais who would come along and translate. He also had bad news. They would have to cross the mountains by traveling through the Salang Tunnel, and that tunnel would close the next morning at 6 a.m. "When will it open again?" Greg asked. Abdullah shrugged. 12 hours, 2 days, who can know?" Greg began to repack his suitcases. Before they reached the Salang Tunnel, Greg fell asleep in the car. He woke when the jeep stopped in perfect darkness. They were inside the tunnel, and the jeep's radiator had quit working. The car was stuck, and in the worst possible place in the tunnel. Greg and Abdullah peered under the hood, trying to figure out if they could fix the problem, when a truck roared downhill toward them. The driver could not see the jeep until he was almost upon it. At the last moment, he swerved, ripping off the jeep's side view mirror as he drove by. "Let's go!" Greg yelled. The three ran along the tunnel's wall and found a doorway to the outside. But the moment Greg looked at the ground, he stopped. He'd spotted a stone that was painted red, then another, and another. There are millions of landmines buried all over Afghanistan, left there by armies after years and years of war. When one is found, usually because it explodes, rocks in the area are painted red as a warning. Even though children are taught about landmines in school, hundreds still die every year from stepping on them. Greg knew that they did not dare try to keep walking. The tunnel was dangerous, but not half as dangerous as walking through landmines. They ducked back inside. I don't know what would have happened if the next vehicle wasn't a truck, climbing slowly uphill, Greg said. But thank God it was. I jumped out in front of it and flagged it down. There were 5 men in the truck, smugglers, with a load of stolen refrigerators. But they let Greg and Kais ride in the truck's cab, shared a bunch of grapes with them, and the truck pushed their jeep, with Abdullah steering it uphill. When they reached the top of the hill, still inside the tunnel, Abdullah, Greg, and Kais climbed into their jeep. They coasted down the hill and out into the daylight. I was so happy to get out of that tunnel and into the light that I hugged Abdullah so hard I almost made him crash the jeep, Greg said. They managed to repair the radiator with a piece cut from the spare tire and some duct tape from Greg's backpack and were back on their way. They continued on until evening, when suddenly a burst of machine gun fire from up ahead made Abdullah slam on the brakes. He backed the jeep up quickly, and more gunshots came from behind. Come, Abdullah ordered, pulling Greg and Kais out of the jeep and into a muddy ditch where they lay face down, hoping to keep out of the way of bullets. They'd found themselves in the middle of a battle between 2 gangs of opium smugglers. Opium is an addictive drug made from poppy seeds. They fired back and forth at each other, over our heads, Greg said. I stopped thinking about escape and started thinking about my kids, trying to imagine how Tara would explain the way I died to them, and wondering if they would understand what I was trying to do, how I didn't mean to leave them, that I was trying to help kids like them over here. I decided Tara would make them understand, and that was a pretty good feeling. Then headlights appeared from an approaching truck, and the gunfire died down. Abdullah jumped out of the ditch to wave the truck down and called Kais to translate as he asked for a ride for the foreigner Greg. Abdullah called Greg to come. Greg ran from the ditch and jumped in the back of the truck, which was filled with goat hides. Abdullah threw a goat hide over him to hide him from view. What about you and the boy? Greg asked. Allah will watch over us, said Abdullah. The smugglers were shouting at each other, not at them. We wait, then take the jeep back to Kabul, Abdullah said, and he slapped the back of the truck with his hand. It jolted away along the highway. Under a pile of rotting goat skins, Greg covered his nose with his hand and watched the gunfire resume, hoping Abdullah was right. He was. Kais and Abdullah would make it safely back to Kabul, but Greg wouldn't learn that until the following week. As the truck rolled on, Greg realized that he was going to have to go without dinner. He had a bag of peanuts in his backpack, but his backpack, he remembered, was still in the jeep. In it, along with the peanuts, was the king's business card with his thumbprint on the back. He felt the pockets of his vest, and luckily he still had his passport and some American money. I was alone, Greg said later. I was covered in mud and goat blood. I'd lost my luggage. I didn't speak the local language. I hadn't had a meal for days, but I felt surprisingly good. I felt like I had all those years earlier, riding up the Indus Gorge, with my supplies for the Corfe school, having no clue what was ahead of me. My plan for the next few days was vague, and I had no idea if I'd succeed, but you know what? It wasn't a bad feeling at all. The truck dropped Greg off in Faizabad. He slept in the hallway of a hotel. The next morning he found a father and son who agreed to drive him in another jeep to Sadar Khan's headquarters in the city of Baharak. Khan was a commandant, a man who ruled the province of Badakhshan as if he were its king. He was known as a smart and ruthless fighter, and he had his own militia, soldiers who were his private army. He could be harsh and cruel to his enemies, but he also took care of the people of Badakhshan who were loyal to him. Greg knew that he needed Khan on his side if he wanted to build schools in this area. It took 3 hours to reach Bar Rock, as the jeep crept along ledges above a river that wound through a rocky canyon. Finally, they drove into the marketplace of the town. The only other car there was a white jeep. Greg waved it down. He figured that anyone who could afford such a good jeep would know where to find Sardar Khan. The driver, a man with piercing black eyes and a neatly trimmed beard, got out to talk to Greg. "I'm looking for Sardar Khan," Greg said in Dari, the local language. He'd gotten Kais to teach him a few words on the drive from Kabul. "He is here," the man said in English. "Where?" "I am he. I am Commandant Khan." It was Friday, the Muslim holy day. Greg waited nervously on the roof of Sardar Khan's compound as the Commandant went to the mosque to pray with the other village men. On the rooftops of buildings nearby, men with guns kept an eye on the Americans' movements. To the southeast, Greg could see the snowy peaks of Pakistan's mountains. He knew that Faisal Beg's village of Zut Khan was not far. In his mind, he drew lines that ran from Beg to the schools he'd build and the villages he'd spent so much time in, connecting people and places he knew and loved to this lonely rooftop. He told himself that he was not alone. Then Khan returned from his prayers. "And what has an American come so far from Kabul to talk about?" he asked. Greg told the warlord his story. He explained how Kyrgyz horsemen had ridden into Pakistan to find him and ask him for his help. He told of his trip from Kabul, the gunfight by the roadside, his escape under the goatskins. Then the fearsome Afghan warlord did something astonishing. He shouted with joy and wrapped Greg in a huge hug. "Yes, yes, you're Dr. Greg," he exclaimed. One of his men, Abdul Rashid, had told him all about Greg. "This is incredible," Khan said, pacing with excitement. "And to think I didn't even arrange a meal or a welcome from the village elders. Forgive me." Khan ordered a feast to be prepared for his American guest. Then he and Greg walked in circles on the roof, discussing where to build schools. Khan knew all there was to know about the places where Greg was eager to begin work. Quickly, he listed 5 villages that needed schools, and he told Greg about all the girls in the area who had nowhere to study. In Faizabad alone, he said, 5,000 teenage girls were trying to hold classes in the fields outside the boys' high school. As the sun started to set behind the Pamir Mountains to the west, Khan put one hand on Greg's back and pointed with the other. "Look here. Look at these hills," he went on. "There has been far too much dying in those hills. Each stone in the mountains," Khan said, "stood for a martyr, someone who died in a battle. Now we must make their sacrifice worthwhile," he finished, turning to Greg. "We must turn those stones into schools." In that moment, Greg Mortensen saw what the rest of his life would be like. There would be new languages and new customs to learn. He would spend months apart from his family. There would be dangers he couldn't yet imagine. Greg put his hands on Sardar Khan's shoulders, just as he had done to Haji Ali so many years ago. Once long ago, he decided to climb the second highest mountain in the world in his sister's honor. Now, looking into the eyes of an Afghan warlord, he dedicated himself to climbing an even higher mountain, to keep bringing education, hope, and chances of a better life to the children of Afghanistan and Pakistan. Krista would have been proud. This is Atossa Leone. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of 3 Cups of Tea, the Young Readers Edition. The foreword was read by Vanessa Redgrave. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced and directed by Kevin Thompson, with original music composed by John Bowers. 3 Cups of Tea is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA, Inc., copyright 2009. All rights reserved. The book 3 Cups of Tea is available wherever Puffin books are sold.
Audible Kids hopes you have enjoyed this audiobook.
For more like it, check out kids.audible.com.